This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by...
With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration.
And also by...
Hey everybody, Mark Davin from Guitar Radio Show. Have you heard about Lock Knob? LockKnob.com? Lock Knob is a revolutionary product invented by a musician for musicians, solving the long-time problem of lost settings. How many times have you been at a gig or a session only to have to reset all of your settings on your amp or your pedals because they move during transit? You can upgrade your existing knobs on your amp, pedals, mixer, guitar, almost anything with a pot, with an all-aluminum quality-made reusable knob that does more than just look pretty. Never lose your settings again. Lock it down with Lock Knob. Go to LockKnob.com for more.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
Hey! It's episode 146 of Guitar Radio Show. Welcome. We've got a cool one today. I think we always do. But we've got a cool one today. It's Ron Bumblefoot Thal. This guy is, I'm telling you, and you'll hear me say it again in the interview, I think if Zappa was still alive, Bumblefoot would be in that band. He would be his guitar player. He's just a consummate musician, and he uses the instrument as if it was an orchestra. And you know, that's not something that a lot of guitar players do, but this guy can do it all, and he's really a genius. He really is. He would probably be really embarrassed to hear me say that, but it's true. I really think he is. And today we talk to him, and we get in real deep and discuss his career and some of his records in particular, some of the ones that I really dig. And it's a really good conversation. So that's today, Wednesday. Tomorrow on Thursday on GuitarRadioShow.com, we have another blog from Adam P. Hunt. It is on doom metal. I like stoner metal, but this one's on doom metal. And it's 500 words on doom metal, and Adam covers it. And he gives us some examples of who he thinks is the finest in that genre. What do you think of that? Huh? Nice, right? We've got some cool things coming up in the month of October. We've got some really cool interviews, and we've got a giveaway that's coming up with checkered pedals on a really cool phase pedal that they make. And we do an interview with... Rick from Checker Pedals, and I think you're going to dig that too. That's coming up in October, along with a whole bunch of other really cool things. In the meantime, here's a little snippet of some Bumblefoot, and then we're going to get right into the interview with him. And once again, it's great to have him on, and he was one of those people that I've been wanting to have on for a long time, since the get. So, you ready? Here we go. Guitar Radio Show, guitarradioshow.com.
Dude, guitars suck. Guitars suck. Guitars suck!
Hey people. When I started this show, I created a list of people that I wanted on this show, and I said, okay, I'm not going to ask these people to be on the show until there's enough listeners. Well, we got enough listeners now, and I finally got to reach out, got the gumption, and reached out to Mr. Ron Bumblefoot Thal, and he's here with us on Guitar Radio Show. How are you, Ron?
Good, man. Very good. Thank you so much. So, yeah, he had this whole big list of people.
Yeah.
And he was waiting until he had a huge amount of listeners, and he couldn't get any of those people, so he called me, and I was like, yeah.
No, the other way around, man.
So, how's everything?
Good, man. You know, it's funny. I was listening back to, because I've been into you since the 9/11 record. And that's when you came into my consciousness. And especially when I saw there was a title on the record called Guitars Suck. I was like, what? What does he mean by that? And then I went and I listened to it. And you know, it's so funny because I liken that record to if when Shostakovich was around, there was the same kind of technology that we have now. If he played guitar, that's what he would do. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? It makes sense to me.
Well, I don't know if I agree, but it makes sense.
Right?
I mean, I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would, you know, align myself with anybody whose name has lasted hundreds of years, but thank you.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's it's funny because I remember, you know, when I was a classical guitar major in college, and of course they had, you know, music appreciation class, which was not an elective. You had to take it as a music major. And we would sit there and the teacher, you know, this crusty old guy would put on, you know, Shostakovich, and I'd be like, "What the fuck am I hearing? This is messing with my head." And then, you know, and at the same time, but at the same time, back then, I was also listening to Zappa. So I was able to draw a line between the two. But then when I heard the 9/11 record, I was like, ah, there we go. This is more like that. To me, that's what that is.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
You and I have a couple of things in common. We're both born in New York. I was born in Jamaica, Queens. You were born in Brooklyn.
All right.
And we both had that same moment when we saw and heard Kiss Alive. That
yep.
made
a New York thing for sure.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think, you know, because they were from there and there was so much press about them there. I mean, you know, we would get Rock Scene magazine and Hit Parader and Circus, which all came out of New York. With the exception of Cream, which I think was coming out of L.A. But when I heard A Kiss Alive, I said, I want to be Gene Simmons.
There you go, same thing.
I wanted to play bass. So, and an uncle, you know, asked me, he said, "What are you going to do with your life?" I was 12. "What are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "Well, I want to play bass." He goes, "Oh," he was a lounge singer. He says, "I have a bass," and he gave me a bass, and that was it. And I was off to the races. And it was kind of similar for you in that way, that you heard that and that was it. You all of a sudden it became very clear as to what you were going to do. Is that still pretty? Is that still pretty visceral for you?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's completely yes.
Yeah, and I once heard you say that guitar was your medication. So when you say that, I mean, is it because some people look at the guitar as a tool and some people look at it as a companion. Which of it is it for you?
Well, I couldn't get real medication, so I had to settle for guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That was a joke. bad joke, I suck. So, no, it's all those things. It's not one or the other. It's everything. It's your companion. It's your... You know, it's a tool, it's a weapon, it's a loved one, it's a vessel, it is an outlet, it is a voice. it's everything you want it to be, it can be, and is.
It's
all those things.
Yeah. In those early days, were you one of those people that it was always strapped around you and you were always with it? Or were you one of those?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was like Linus's blanket,
Right.
That thing was just always on my mind. It's funny. I remember, being in school. The funny thing I remember is being in French class. I took 7 years of French and barely learned a thing because the whole time I just sat in class just writing songs, and I would sit there just writing out music and not paying attention. And of course, the first place that I ended up touring was France, and I'm kicking myself like, I should have studied.
But
it was always, I have very vivid memories of just that it, I don't know if you can call it addiction or a codependency or a drug or what it is, but just that thing that you get from music and from guitar and from, or whatever it is that you use to make music, that connecting thing for me was guitar. That was the thing that allowed me to plug in to music and be connected to it. It's just always there, and you just, we say that that younger age, like you just couldn't wait to get all those other worldly distractions away so that it could just be you and your guitar just being creative and just whatever it is, jamming with your band and just letting your energy out or writing music and anything. It's whatever you want it to be, it's there for that, and it doesn't let you down.
And for you, it was guitar right from the get-go, right? It wasn't like you were like...
Actually, no, it wasn't. I wanted to be a drummer first.
Oh, okay.
My older brother, he wanted to be a drummer too, so he was like, all right, well, I'm going to be the drummer. And then I was like, all right, well, Gene Simmons is my favorite Kiss character. I want to be a bass player. So I went to a music store and with my mom and said, I want to take bass lessons. And they looked at me and... if you stood me next to a bass was taller than I was. There was no way I was going to have the wingspan to be able to play one. So they lied to me. They kicked me into playing guitar. The guy at the music store, he said that the rule is you have to play a kid-sized acoustic guitar for 2 years before you can play bass. Even at that age, I was like, this guy's jacking me. What are you talking about? I was like, all right, whatever I gotta do. So I started playing guitar, and I just studied, going through the Mel Bay books and just being very academic about it on the side. I would write songs and play with my band and do all that stuff, record and do everything else, and every once in a while maybe I would learn a riff or two from a song from my guitar teachers, but mostly it was just going through all the academic stuff.
Right. So was it Mel Bay?
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember that blue book.
Yeah.
And I still remember all the stuff in it. I could play it for you just out of my brain. All the songs, 3-4 times. The Merry Men. We finally learned the B string. It was like G-F-D-D-C-B-C-E-G.
Right. Yeah.
And the sad thing is that I can't remember anybody's name, but I can still remember a song that I worked on playing 40 years ago, in a practice book.
Right. Yeah.
That was the weird thing that started happening too, is getting that memory where when music becomes your language and it becomes part of your flesh, you start to really have that weird connection where, at least for me, you hear something and you know it, and you can just play it and you can repeat it back, what you just heard, and if someone just said the words to you, and then you say the words back. So it started getting that way, where I think I just started trading brain cells. I'll trade in my good common sense for the ability to recognize recognize chords and all, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. But were there ever times where you were supposed to be learning something, but you would have heard it and you actually learned it by ear before you actually learned how to read it?
That started happening too. Yeah, the ears became more like eyes.
Yeah.
Over time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that happens. Yeah, the more, just like anything, music is a language,
mm-hmm.
and the more you hear that language, the more you can identify the words, the letters, the phrases, the intentions, all mm-hmm. of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's what happens. So doing that at a young age, by the time I was old enough, the people were maybe first starting, and I was already playing for like 6 or 7 years or something like that. So I was definitely and it was real easy to learn songs. All I had to do was hear it, and I would practice that too.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would all the time. I would just say, today I'm going to learn this album. And what I would do is I would just drop the needle for 3 seconds, retain whatever I just heard in my head, and then play it back, and then drop it back down and continue a little more and just keep doing that. And I would just learn an entire album. And by the time I got to the end of the album, I pretty much forgot a lot of the stuff at the beginning of the album. But it gets you in the practice of just using your ears and retaining
mm-hmm.
and getting it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped a lot. I would just learn songs on the spot. even with Guns N' Roses, I did that. When I first joined the band, I had to learn Half a Chinese Democracy just by listening to it. Like, they wouldn't give me a copy of it. So I had to listen one time with pen and paper, with headphones in the rehearsal room on the road manager's laptop, and I would just write down what I heard, just making scribbly notes to myself. And while the band was waiting in the other room, and then we went and just started playing.
That's insane. Talk about being accommodating. Jesus Christ. Yeah, we want to give you a shot.
Do what you got to do.
Yeah, I know, but it's like crazy. It's like, we want to give you a shot, man. We want to give you a shot. Yeah, we're just going to, we're just going to let you look inside the box for a second. Okay, now, figure it out.
Well, that's what you got to be able to do.
I'm telling you, it's crazy. I mean, it's funny. I had Wadi Wattel on the show, and he told me that, when he was taking lessons back in the day, when he was younger, he would hear it before he would learn how to read it, and he'd go back to his lesson and he'd start to play it, and the guy would be like, well, you're not reading it, you're just playing it. He goes, well, I heard it and now I know how to play it. He goes, no, but you got to read it. He goes, but I heard it, now I know how to play it. He goes, here, I know how to play your part too, here, check it out. And he would play his part too, and so it was frustrating for the teacher, but it's interesting when you've got somebody with a brain like that who can digest the material in that manner and then be able to go, here it is. It really is kind of a rarity. There aren't a lot of people who can do that. So that's kind of interesting to me.
It's good for the ears, but it's bad for the reading.
Yeah.
Like, I get it now, like, looking back on something like that. Like, this is not helping you learn to read or to sight read or anything like that.
Right.
It's cheating.
It's cheating?
it's cheating. It is. It's using your ears to cheat.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as if you're writing the answers on the inside of your hand and you're looking at that.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. But ultimately, what is the end goal?
Yeah.
Play the music.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever it takes for you to play the music, do it.
Yeah.
I say cheat.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Use all your abilities, all mm-hmm. your assets. If you have great ears and you can read, it's just like a singer. If they have a teleprompter, they may not need to look at it, but it's there in case they need
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
same
true.
Thing. Use your ears, but if you forget a part, you have the music in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. I guess it's not really cheating. It's just that you simply have additional stuff.
Yeah. Have you ever consciously thought about, the fact, when I hear you play, I hear, especially when you're doing a solo, your solos are songs within the songs, which is a very, very frailly way of doing it. You know, I always looked at Ace Frehley as he was doing songs within the songs. That's what his solos were. And I hear your solos, and there are songs within the songs, but beyond that, I hear that blues-based, hard rock, Frehley-esque vibe, and then you're able to meld that world with the later 80s kind of, and I hate the hate this freaking word.
Shredded?
Yeah, I hate that word. It's stupid. But
well, it's like, you know what, it's okay because we are a culmination of our experiences and our timelines.
I know, but
stuff.
But it also
yeah,
conjures
it's
up. It also conjures up other kind of, you know, more cheesy things to me anyway. But you're able to fuse those worlds together and go in and out and weave that. It's really interesting to hear that, your influences through what you do. Have you ever really kind of thought about that, or was it just a natural happening?
No, I don't think about that. If you think about it, you start to create boundaries and lines that you're trying to stay in and things like that.
Right.
Better off just kind of close your eyes and drive and see what you hit.
I like that. I like that. I want that on a t-shirt. That's yeah, totally. So when it is time for you to cut a solo, it's kind of just like, okay, we're gonna freewheel here. We're just gonna, you know, live without a net attitude.
Well, I mean, a few things will a few things will come into play. Yeah. You can edit that out.
No, I'm leaving that in.
You can leave all that out. So, no, but yeah, a few things do come into play.
Yeah.
Like, in the process, it's like, first you think, all right, what is the vibe of the song? And then you say, all right, are there any other melodies that I can sort of tip a hat to within the song, or ideas to connect it? And then you say, all right, now let's just see where it goes. And usually I'm just starting a little more melodic and let it build into something a little crazier, and then pull back and finish a little melodic. That just tends to, I've noticed, the way I like to, you know, are you allowed to curse on this thing?
Yeah, go.
Okay. It's kind of like fucking.
Okay.
It's, you know, just think of, all right, I'm going to fuck for 30 seconds, which is pretty realistic for most guitar players. And, so, you know, are you going to start off like, you know, a 14-year-old fucking for the first time and just go, you know, or are you going to kind of ease in and build up and hit that big moment?
Right.
You know, you just got to think of it like in a weird way, it's kind of like that.
Right.
Sometimes you do want to go for the 14-year-old jackhammer, and other times you want to just take it easy. It depends on, you know, who the song is.
Uh-huh.
And what they want, and to not be selfish about it.
Okay. Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. I get it. That's cool. So I wanted to ask you about your time with Mike Varney. What was was that good stuff for you? I mean, it was obviously it was a milestone.
It was interesting, you know. It's like, you know, it started off in 1989 when he gave me a write up in the the Spotlight column.
Yeah,
it was, I think, the Jeff Healey issue of, I guess it was Guitar Player magazine. Mm-hmm. In August 89. Yeah, and I remember a year before, I had done an album with my band, which was kind of just like almost like a solo record, but it was just like a bang out 6-song vinyl thing. And I remember sending it to him and didn't get a response back, and I just wanted to say it. I was, my focus, my goal was just to do a band thing. I wanted to have a band, and I wanted to go out there and do what a band does and be part of a band. But on the side, I would make these funny little guitar songs for my own amusement, and people would say, man, you should just send these, like, those guitar did. And first I sent my album in 88 and didn't get any response or anything. I was like, all right, cool. And then in 89, I was like, you know, let me send him some of my funny, weird songs that I'm doing just my own amusement. And I sent, there was one called Sex with Ducks, where there was a big guitar solo in the middle, and all it was using the guitar to make it sound like people moaning and all these ducks quacking. And it was a pretty out there song. I sent him like three or four songs, and he gave me a write-up, and he said some real nice stuff. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, there were a couple of people that wrote to me after I was in that magazine that just kind of like pen pal kind of stuff, like other guitar players, and ended up building some nice friendships. One of them was Guthrie Govan.
Mm-hmm.
He saw that in there, and he wrote me a letter. You know, back then it was all just a stamp and an envelope and pen and paper, and we ended up becoming like these pen pal friends, and we would send each other little cassettes of riffs and songs and ideas we're working on, with little handwritten transcriptions of the ideas and things. So yeah, so he and I have been friends a good 27 years just from, thanks to that magazine.
Wow.
Stuff like that, it's interesting. Yeah. So at the time, I remember Vonnie asked me just what I wanted to do, and I was like, I just want to get my band going. And he offered me a couple of situations that were more instrumental guitar kind of things. I was like, thank you, but I really just want to focus on my band. And you know, this is what I always envisioned, being in a band like Kiss or the Beatles, something where four dudes, you know every single person by a first name basis. Mm-hmm. Each one, you can hear their personality in the music. That kind of band. Mm-hmm. That's what I always wanted. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I was hoping for, shooting for, trying for, working for, living for. And over the years, I always stayed in touch with Mike Bonney. If he came to New York, we would hang out. And then at one point, I remember, I was sending my demos, things I was doing. And just the timing was where he was looking to do vocal music, not just instrumental music. And I was still doing my thing, and we talked. I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's put out some music. So it started off with that Adventures of Bumblefoot album, came out in 95, and then the Hermit album came out in 97, which I am actually in the process of remixing right now. I have that song right up here. Working on it. Try to make it all pretty sounding and get everything nice and clear. Cool. So yeah, the reason I'm remixing it is because The Orchard has bought the entire Shrapnel catalog, and they want to do a re-release of my first two albums, maybe with some additional merch and stuff. And so I'm trying to remix the Hermit album to just give it a clearer, better sound.
That's great.
Interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, yes. So that was the Vonnie years. I did that in 95 and 96. I did the soundtrack to an entire video game for Sega.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they had heard the Adventures album and thought it was the exact kind of wacky thing that they were looking for this one particular strange game called Wild Woody.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the first video games to use actual sound, like recorded 16-bit wave file sound, as opposed to before that everything was just little beeps and, you know, just synth noises and stuff, all 8-bit. So this was one of the first soundtracks to a video game that was going to have actual music, live music.
Mm-hmm.
So did that, then put out the Hermit album in 97, and then in 98 I was finished with the Shrapnel contract and just started putting out my own music and put out the Hands album.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when I hear you play. You know, there's so many freaking guitar players, which is why there can a show like this can exist. But there's a lot of guitar players that won't be on this show because they kind of sound just like the other guy. You, on the other hand, have found yourself this very interesting niche of uniqueness that, you know, I can't find a way to pigeonhole you into any one category. Has that been a good thing or
it's
a bad?
Probably a bad thing.
Is you think it's a bad thing?
I think of it like, I don't know. Like, it's probably better to be one thing and just be solid at that. You know, like, think of it as if you're gonna stock something on a shelf. It's like, I don't know if this is cereal or if this is meat or if this is ice cream.
Yeah.
I don't know where to put this.
Yeah.
So, and that's been a problem a lot of times with record labels and stuff like that. They're like, we just don't know what to do with this.
Well, that's because that, I mean, everybody needs a freaking label, and that's something that drives me crazy because, and I've said this a million times on this show, to me music is a buffet table, and when I get to the buffet table, I'm not just going to load up on the Swedish meatballs.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And the thing with a buffet, though, is also you know what kind of buffet it is usually.
Yeah.
Like, it might be a Chinese, Japanese buffet or something like that, or it might be just barbecue, and like there's usually a foundation to that buffet that you can go by. But I think a lot of times with the music industry, when you're dealing with those who are going to invest their money and their time and their efforts into an artist, they need to be very clear cut. They don't want to take chances. They don't want to risk confusing the consumer in any way and jeopardizing, you know, everybody's best of intentions. So with that, they look at a very clear cut, and that sort of leaves the more eccentric or more experimental artists on their own. You know, if I say, well, ultimately, I'm just, you know, I play hard rock. You know, the cake is hard rock. The icing might be different on different albums, different vibes, sometimes more punky, sometimes a little more progressive, sometimes maybe more instrumental and guitar-centric, but you know, the initial foundation of it always seems to be some kind of hard rock because that's just, that's how I grew up. You know, I grew up on classic rock and then some old school punk and then old school metal and a lot of progressive in there and also listened to jazz and classical and all those things. For anybody, that those are your building blocks. That is, you know, the house that you are. These are the walls and the bricks and everything that makes you what you are.
Right.
So if you're going to invite people into that house, they're going to see all of that stuff in there.
I totally agree with that. I mean, you know, it's for me, I mean, I heard Kiss, and I grew up on Judas Priest and Black Sabbath, and I also like Pat Metheny. So
there you go.
You know, to me, I just, I don't know. I guess maybe it's also the way I was brought up, too. I mean, the house was always filled with music, and there, it was always a myriad of different sounds, so it wasn't just one thing. I think that's also partly the media machine too. It's like this is the status quo. Here is your silver spoon. We're going to jam this down your throat. You know, I think there's been a lot of, you know, the way the record company said, well, we got to sell this now. This is what we got to sell because it's either cheap to produce and easy to package and easy to sell. Let's rewire the public's head. How's that for a conspiracy theory?
There you go.
You know, well, I think you, I mean, you know, you must be doing something right in that, you know, you did some stuff with Joe Satriani. He saw something. Lita Ford saw something, and you ended up in Guns N' Roses. They saw something, so there's something. It's not
I've
that.
Tortured them all.
What? Huh?
I said, and I've tortured them all.
I mean, you're not that left of center.
Actually, it's been absolutely wonderful. Like, you know, any time I... Well, anyone who's ever met Joe Satriani knows he's just a sweetheart of a guy.
Right.
So, I mean, we just jammed once and we would stay in touch when, if Chicken Foot was coming to town and we'd hang. Lita Ford, put together on 2 days' notice, new band for her, and got everything down and hit the road. What else? I've jammed with a lot of people.
Yeah.
MC Sinatra, Alan Toussaint. It's been cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Guys from Anthrax, guys from Kiss. All different people. That's the fun part, just jamming with different people.
Yeah.
Especially with people that their music has meant something to you, and you get to actually make that connection. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But played with a lot of people and going to play with a whole lot more.
That's beautiful. Well, I wanted to talk about a couple of records that have stood out for me over the years. Obviously, like I mentioned about the 9/11 record, which is really kind of, that's my go-to Bumblefoot record when I need a fix. But the Normal record is such a, it's really kind of a departure record for you in some respects. It almost seems like a joyous romp. What was going on during that record for you?
There was a lot of stuff going on in that record. on the surface, it seems really digestible, but let me see. With that record, it started off, I knew I was going to write it, and I wrote the first line, and just got a new medication. Boom, couldn't write for a year and a half once I hit that line. Did other things. I wrote a bunch of other music for publishing libraries that still I hear every day on everything from, it's on the Oprah Winfrey, So You Think You Can Dance, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. It was used for theme songs on different TV shows and everything. And I was producing a ton of bands, a lot of cool bands, local bands. Remember 24/7 Spies?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I did their album and their comeback album. I was recording them. We started around 2004 with that. Just did it in the studio. So what else? So then I started talking with Guns N' Roses and started having their management at the time started having some issues with them, and it sort of broke me out of my funk, and I just started writing a lot of songs like Real, Rockstar for a Day, Life Inside Your Ass. Like all those songs were sort of inspired, and then at the same time that was like a little side story, but the main thing on the album was I just got a new medication. And I couldn't really write and create the same way anymore. I was blocked. So it was a question of, all right, do I want to be clinically happy, or do I want to be creative and feel everything there is to feel, the good and the bad, everything in between?
Mm-hmm.
And making that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end you go for you pick creativity over I guess you'd say I didn't want to live in the matrix. I wanted to see the real ugly world and be part of that.
Yeah.
I should say beautiful and ugly and the gray in between it.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
So that's what that album was kind of about.
Yeah.
And I remember it, like, as I was weaning off the happy stuff, I remember being in, waiting online in the post office, and I could just feel, like, stress on my face. It's hard to explain, but it's almost like, I guess you could say I could feel initial anxiety that wasn't there for a good year and a half, that suddenly, you know, your own internal destructive worst enemy side of you that's there, and I felt it sort of in my face, like a... And then I started writing the song Shadow, and I remember that line, I can feel my face changing. It's like the little things you experience. Like, you can take any songwriter and say, line by line, what does this mean? Where did you get this? That kind of stuff.
Do you ever feel...
So that album was like this deep journey of, you know, just anti-depression medication and going off it to, you know, for the sake of music.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was just saying to myself, thinking to myself, you're like the conduit for your art.
Well, isn't everyone?
Well, I don't know. Some people think they are the art. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you kind of, in a way, you are, I guess. Well, I guess you could say that art is the meat and we are the meat grinder. And that meat is going to come out in any shape depending on what that meat grinder is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we are definitely just a vessel for the meat.
Right. Yeah.
But I guess the way we deliver it and pretty it up on the plate depends on who we are. So it's a bit of both, you know. It's like there's the art, and then there's, well, I guess you could say there's the paint and there's the painter. You know, and the two need to work together to create something.
Right, there needs to be a melding.
But I don't think the painter thinks that they're the paint.
Yeah.
If they do, then...
So last night I was listening to Little Brother Is Watching, and this record is funny because it's got this grandiose feeling to it. It's uplifting. It's Mozart meets Carl Stalling. You know what I mean? You know who Carl Stalling was? He was the composer of all the Bugs Bunny music, all the Looney Tunes music.
That's all right. I was trying to think. It's like, where? What the?
Yeah, it's Mozart meets Carl Stalling. It's this really just up. It's really uplifting
melodies.
Yeah, it's really, and it's very.
It makes you feel good.
Yeah,
that's what it's supposed to do.
That's what it did. It made me feel good. It was up, and I was like, "Wow, this record's bright." You know, if I was to liken it to a shade of light, it's bright light. It's bright sunlight. This record, this was not a dark studio record. This is a bright light record. I really dig it. It's such a good record.
Cool, thank you.
And once again, another departure kind of for you, I think.
From abnormal, I think it's definitely feels cleansed.
Yeah, because abnormal was like a punk record.
Pretty much. It was like an angry or normal.
Yeah, right.
Normal off the meds.
Right. Yeah, totally. So it's kind of cool. I dig that record a lot. I think it's really some of your best work for sure.
Thank you.
Just to steer away from music for a second, tell everybody a little bit about MSRF, the muscular.
They actually closed their doors.
Oh,
they shut down.
Gotta be kidding.
The guy who runs it, you know, he has MS, and it just became too much for him. Too much stress just to have it, to have that organization. It was just too difficult, the responsibility.
Yeah. See, I have a cousin with MS, and when I heard about it, it really kind of struck me. It's like, wow, that's a shame.
But MSRF, yeah, I'll tell you what that was. It was an old student of mine from like 25 years ago that just became a longtime friend, and we were playing together, and then he moved to Puerto Rico and joined a band there, and they were climbing and doing better and better, and things were going great. then he started getting little dizzy spells and started getting tingling and numbness and all different things. And he went to a doctor and he got diagnosed. And he decided that he still wanted to be active in music, entertainment, everything. So he started a nonprofit organization. It was a legit, you know, 501c3. And all his friends and family, we were volunteers that worked with him. And we would do all kinds of fundraising events, whether it was concerts or having comedians, like dinner comedy stuff. And all the money, it didn't get donated to another organization. It went right to the labs and the researchers to fund all the work they were doing. And we would go to the labs and you know, meet with everybody and discuss the plan of attack and what they're shooting for and what the goals are. And yeah. So did that for a good, well over 10 years. But it reached a point where it was too much for Ralph.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that, because it was something that was...
Okay. I mean, we did what we could. I think total, I think it was around $100,000 that we were able to put right into these labs and all, right into the research.
That's great.
And,
yeah.
You know, one of the things they were working on was trying to crack the genetic code of cells, where there were four stages of the cells, and they got it up to stage 3, where they were going to reprogram cells to, you know, to fix the myelin sheath on the nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, there was one point they just could not get it past. But, you know, you try and then you try something else. You just keep doing what you can and seeing how far you can get.
That's cool.
They were everyone was very dedicated to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe somebody will pick it up and they want to do something with it. That would be amazing.
Well, there's enough organizations and you know, just everything. There's a lot of support for trying to find a cure or at least maintaining quality of life for people and trying to ease the progression of the disease.
Yeah. Cause
there's a whole world of people out there doing what they can.
Yeah, I mean, because I've seen what it does, and it just ravages somebody, you know, somebody that was so vital, and just ravages them. It's horrible.
Sure. It's a very unusual disease. There's a lot of different types.
Yeah.
You know, if you have the primary progressive, which is just a slow, steady loss of control and mobility, compared to some people that have a lot of remissions, and it's almost like just a nuisance compared to, you know, someone that ends up, you know, just completely immobilized by it.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out why this disease is different in different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it had just one result, it would probably be easier to pin down and figure out.
Yeah.
But why are there remissions in some and not in the other?
Yeah.
Why can some people live with it okay, and some people it just kicks their ass? And what are the other factors?
Right. And it's probably just gene coding.
Probably.
Yeah.
But we don't know. I mean, it could be so many things. It could be such a combination of everything from diet to genetics to who knows. Beyond me.
Yeah. Is it? I mean, I heard a rumor that you were an adjunct professor at SUNY Purchase.
This is true. Yes, from around 2002. In fact, I was just there a couple of months ago, giving a lecture or two and jamming with students. Yes, I was Professor Bumblefoot, an adjunct professor of music at SUNY Purchase College.
I love it.
That is right. I went from high school dropout to college professor.
That's fantastic. So you were teaching music production? Is that what you were doing, teaching music production there?
There I was doing some, you know, instrument music stuff, but but a lot of it was, the main classes that I taught were music production. Mm-hmm. I would do all kinds of crazy stuff where I would just throw something against a wall, and the sound that it makes hitting off the wall to the ground, say, okay, take that rhythm, we're going to make a song out of that.
Yeah.
I would take them in for a drive in the car and a couple of the students, and we would just go outside and listen and just kind of pinpoint what we were hearing.
Yeah.
Down to the more, you know, just technical stuff, you know, the attack, decay, sustain, release, and of, you know, just talking about, big thing was understanding compression and how to use it. Mm. A lot of people don't really understand how to shape a wave using compression. So mm-hmm. getting into that, because it could bring the life out of something or suck the life out of something.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I swear to God, I swear, you know, if Zappa was alive, I think you'd be in the band. No, I mean, seriously. You would be, I could just hear that. And you know, because that whole idea of, and I could also hear you, like, doing a collaboration with Brian Eno. How cool would that be?
Interesting. I'm down.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I'm going to email him. Let's talk about your gear, man, because I'm fascinated with the fretless guitar, and you were actually the first person I ever saw play a fretless guitar, fretless electric especially. What's the approach? How does it differ when, especially on the double neck? How do you change your approach drastically when you go from one neck to the other, fretless, non fretless?
It's not drastic. You just on a fretted guitar, you're putting your fingers behind the fret so that the string touches the fret and vibrates from the fret to the bridge. With a fretless, being that there's no frets, you have to put your finger exactly where the fret would be, mm-hmm. and the string is going to vibrate from your fingertip to the bridge. So you have to have good intonation with your hands. It's pretty much like a cello, in the same way you wouldn't bend on a cello,
right?
But you can on a fretted instrument. You would just slide up to whatever you would bend to,
right?
So let's say you wanted to bend a whole step on a fretted guitar. All you do is you just hit the note and you slide up a whole step,
mm-hmm.
and the vibrato that you give it with your fingers, instead of being up and down on a fretted, they're more along the length of the string.
Mm-hmm.
Cello-ish.
Yeah, okay, I get that. I get that, because I play upright bass, and I get that. I understand that part of it.
Yeah, so same kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. I've never played
you
one.
You can do things where you can... Oh, the fun as hell.
Yeah.
You can hit harmonics, and then as the harmonics are ringing, you just...
slide them
gently up. Press against the fretboard and slide them around.
Yeah,
you can get a lot of interesting sounds, like yeah. Tony Franklin would do on the bass,
right? Or Jaco, yeah.
Or Jaco, sure.
Yeah,
Jaco. I just saw the documentary on him.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah, some great footage in that.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah, and sad at the same time, and a lot of stuff that I didn't know.
Yeah.
I had a good friend who was a engineer back in the day, and he engineered a bunch of sessions that Jaco did, and everybody would always, you know, he would show up in the control room, plug in, knock it out one maybe two takes, and then he'd be gone like a ghost. It was crazy, just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now things have changed since then.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Now, as far as like back then, people would go and they would bang out one or two takes. I guess people still do that, but now, because we have the technology where you're not going to wear the tape down till it's, you know, clear, the fact that you can do overdubs on layers and pick and choose, people are doing a lot more takes now.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they don't have to, just because they can.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it is actually making people a little more reliant on the technology where they do have to. I think if you could only get it in one take, everybody would walk into the studio one take ready.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But now it's kind of like, all right, I'm just going to do this like crap, and you can tune it and nudge it.
And chop it up and
yeah, I'm not going to
copy and paste.
Quantize my drums and then replace the sounds.
Yeah,
with,
yeah.
You know, with sounds of someone that really knows how to hit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. You know, I had heard that you had did some music, some background stuff for a couple of different things like Osbournes and Road Rules and stuff like that. And it was I don't know what years those were, but I know I was with a music library during that time period too, and I did some background stuff for Osbournes and Road Rules and The Real World and stuff like that.
Well, the Bun and Murray production stuff,
right. And
yeah,
we would go in. We would go in, you know, and they'd be like, "Okay, it's jazz today." Or you go in and like, "You're gonna do country tunes today." And then we would do like 35 freaking takes of one particular run, and then they would chop it up and copy and paste it and stick it all together, and off it would go. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that whole thing of going in and just kind of, you know, really nailing it down that one good take, you know. But, yeah, that's kind of interesting. But back to the gear. So is that double neck gear pretty much your main accent now, or what's that all about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that I pretty much take everywhere. Rather than taking a fretted and a fretless guitar and having a slow one while catching the other one and just having it all in one body is exactly what I need.
Right.
Before I had to choose between either fretted or fretless, and now I don't have to choose. Now I can just jump to the other neck, jump right back, and way better.
That's great. And what
it's heavy. It's heavy as fuck. But,
what kind of wood?
Definitely helps you. I don't know. I should know this. And every time I look it up, people ask me, and I forget.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm so bad when it comes to that kind of stuff. Like, I don't even know what wood my guitars are made out of.
Yeah.
I think it's alder. Let me see. I'm going to go online right now and see.
Okay.
VGA. Oh, and for those people listening, it's a VGA guitar. VGA guitar. VIGIER. Made in France. Company's been around for 35 years. They're a boutique company.
Yep.
And they just make phenomenal stuff.
Yeah, they do.
They play great. They feel great. Sound great.
I played one in May in Dallas, and it was quite astounding.
They make some good stuff.
Yeah. And what about pickups in there?
The pickups, those are DiMarzios. It has, by the neck, DiMarzio Chopper, which is a really nice sounding, very articulate neck pickup.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of has the character of a single coil, but the fullness of a humbuck.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the bridge, it's a Tone Zone. And then I have a 5-way selector, which gives it, setting one is the Tone Zone, setting two is Tone Zone as a single coil. Setting three is the two pickups together of the Tone Zone and the Chopper. Setting four is the two together but out of phase. And then the five is just the Chopper.
Hmm. I like
the let's see.
I like the Tone Zone.
Yeah, those things are great.
Yeah.
Okay, solid body, number of strings, 2x6 type, bolt on, featuring the 1090 system. Yeah, there's no truss rod. It uses kind of that graphite.
Mm-hmm. It's a composite neck. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those 10% carbon, 90% wood. Let's see, the neck is maple, naturally dried for 3 years.
Hmm.
Let's see, the fingerboard, rosewood for the fretted neck. And something they call eye metal for the fretless neck, which is some secret metal that only the French know.
French metal.
The body, two center joined pieces of solid, naturally aged alder.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
There we go. Alder, I gotta remember that.
It's probably, I mean, what's probably making it so heavy is probably the fretless neck, too. It's probably a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, we're thinking about redesigning it, too, to make it less neck heavy. balance it out a bit. Maybe extending the upper horn and things like that. We gotta figure something out with that.
Maybe chamber the neck or something like that too.
Something.
Yeah. Are you a pedal guy or not pretty much just right into the amp kind of guy?
You know, I want to be more of a pedal guy. I just don't have the pedals. I have, like, I'm looking for new, exciting, interesting sounds. I have an Exotic, X-O-T-I-C, wah pedal, which I love. It has all the controls on the sides for everything to really shape the wah in a way that you can only usually do in just a rack-mounted, you know, wah thing. Got an EP booster from them as well, which really just, it's like adding mastering to your guitar. It just makes the sound better, brings everything a little closer. Great. But really, mostly what I have is a bunch of TC Electronic stuff. The Tolton Prince, love those things.
Yeah.
They just sound amazing, and you could go so deep into them and get so many sounds out of them. They just, those damn things are great.
Yeah, their delay is great too. The one that flashback, the three in a row, is intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And amplifiers?
Amplifiers. My main amp is an Engel Invader 100 watt all tube head. It's got four channels on it. Each one has more balls than the next. And it has that nice warm mid tone to it of classic amps. You know, it's just not all shrilly, scooped out. It really sounds like a nice warm amp, but the thing cooks, man. It really, it's got a lot of energy to it.
Yeah,
you don't need a distortion box with this thing at all. It has more than you'll ever need.
Cool.
Just from the preamps.
So what's next for you? What's ahead?
Let me see. Well, I just got home 2 years ago from something called Corfu Rock School. And just to go backwards, what's behind? What's immediately behind? And it is ahead because I'll do it again next year and hopefully the year after and year after that. It's on a Greek island, the island of Corfu. And people from all around the world, the students, we all get together and we spend a week of just music stuff. We, you know, I'm teaching them about songwriting, about business, publishing, copyrights, about working in band situations, locking in with the drummer, about guitar technique, about music theory, just everything. And we work on songs as well, and a couple of nights during that week, we go out, we play the local venues, local bars, and we just play all night. So it's great. So we did that, had a fantastic time. Then I'm going to plug it. Corfu, C-O-R-F-U, rockschool.com.
Cool.
Do it, I think next July we're going to do it again. Fantastic time, just a great vibe. And in a beautiful place where you get to hang out at the beach and just enjoy. And delicious Greek food. So good. So the next thing coming up is, in a week, I'm going to do Great Guitar Escape, which is a whole bunch of guitar players get together and we talk to a whole bunch of students, same kind of thing. So that's a good one. That thing is, that's Paul Gilbert's baby. And I think this is the third one he's doing. And I'm going to do that with Kiko Lorero and Andy Timmons. Dave Ellison's going to be there. And I don't want to leave anybody out. I know Bruce Boulay is going to be there. And who am I missing? I'm missing somebody. I'm having a brain fart. Hang on 1 second. Let's look this up. Okay. Great Guitar Escape. It's in California, in Cambria, which is sort of halfway between San Francisco and L.A. It's in a real beautiful spot. So that's going to be cool. That's going to be 4 days of just serious guitar stuff. Mimi Fox. There we go. Mimi.
OK. Very cool. And Boulay, you said? Bruce Boulay, is that too?
Now, why is his name... They're not showing his name on this. I hope he didn't split. Let me see. Artist Paul Gilbert. Special guests Kiko, Ellison, Andy Timmons, Bumblefoot, Mimi Fox. Maybe Bruce couldn't do it. At the beginning, he was on. Now I'm looking at the site, and it looks like he's not on there. Something must have come up. Damn. All right, so Doug Doppler, Stig Matheson, and on drums, Jeff Bowders. So it's a nice group. You got Kiko and Ellison. I'm there, and Andy Timmons and Mimi Fox, and then Doug Doppler, Stig Matheson, Jeff Bowders, and of course, the great Paul Gilbert running the whole shebang.
That is insane.
So we're going to do that. Let me see. After that, what's coming up? Then it's August. I'm going to be heading down to Brazil and doing some workshops and shows down there. Then I'm going and doing a guitar festival in Romania.
Wow.
And I'm seeing about possibly doing maybe like a two-day little guitar camp in New York if I pull it together quick enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's going to happen short notice. It's going to take time. After that, I'm supposed to go on a tour of Ukraine and Russia and Israel, and we'll see if that definitely happens. After that, probably, hopefully, get back to business with Art of Anarchy, do some more recording, writing, and let's see. Then in November, I might do possibly the UK, and then I'm going to Bahrain doing something with the Holly Davidson folks out there. And in February, there's the 20th anniversary of, it's kind of like Sturgis, big bike rally in Thailand. And it's that 20th anniversary, so I'm going to play that again. I did the last 2 years of it. Fantastic. So I'm definitely going to hit that again.
Wow. Do you ever sleep?
I used to. In the 90s.
Yeah, man.
I'm trying to like thin out everything. Like, it's been twice as much. It has been the craziest schedule for 20 years, and I've truly, truly overdid it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, to the breaking point. Like, I gotta slow down. For my brain and my body.
Yeah.
And you just start stopping and smelling the flowers a bit.
Yeah, I can dig it. Well, Ron, man, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I've been waiting to talk to you for about 4 years now.
Why didn't you just hit me up?
Well, I wanted to wait till we got to 44 million downloads, and once we got to that, I was like, okay, now it's time to hit the people up that I really wanted on the show from the get. So.
It is an absolute pleasure, and I thank you so much for having me on. And everybody listening, thank you so much for listening.
Absolutely. Hold on 1 second, but we're going to sign off right here.
Cool.
Well, there you have it. Wasn't that cool? Damn, that was cool. I love him. He's so freaking talented, and he's just a genius. Genius guitar player. Thank you, Ron, for being on the show, and we wish him nothing but the best. He's got a lot of cool things going on in October. Let's see where he is in October. Where is that? Hang on. Hold on to yourself there. What the hell's the matter with you? There we go. In October, October 19th, he's at the Rock Pile in Toronto, Canada, with the Platinum All-Star. It's Bumblefoot, Carmine Appice, Rudy Sarzo, Jeff Downs, Gene Cornish, and Phil Narro. October 19th in Toronto, Canada, at the Rock Pile. October 22nd at the Arcade Theater in St. Charles, Illinois. And then right after the first of the year, we're looking at Guitarist with the Stowaways, an all-star band at the Shiprock Music Cruise that departs from Miami, Florida. That sounds like fun. That's cool. And then, in February, he's performing at the Barapa Bike Fest in Pattaya, Thailand. Whoa! That's cool. Go to bumblefoot.com for more information on Ron and all his doings. That's cool. He's got a lot of cool stuff going on. All right, cool. Hey, I wanted to remind you that in the month of October, we got some cool stuff. I wanted to tell you what we've got going on in the month of October. Where the hell is my calendar? There it is. Month of October, we've got Sasha Dunnable from Dunnable Guitars, which is going to be really cool. He's a DIY guy. I love his guitars. And he actually was just noticed by Premier Guitar Magazine. Finally, people are waking up. We've got Dan Boole from 65 Amps, and he's got that guy's got a story to tell. He is one of the guys in the boutique amp market that is really just brilliant and a great guy to talk to. We've got our Checkered Pedals giveaway coming up, and we're going to have our interview with Rick from Checkered Pedals. And then, of course, we have Rick Emmett from Triumph, formerly of Triumph. Now he has a new record out on the Mascot label. That's coming. And that will be coming up to round off the end of October. So, October is going to be fun, too. Wait till you see what November's got. Cool stuff. All right, we got to get out of here. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Keep on playing. And please, buy it. Don't steal it. What you say? What you say about that? We'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
Now everybody say, F you, Ed.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.
New episodes of Guitar Radio Show air every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, Player FM, Podomatic, and of course on GuitarRadioShow.com.